This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got two sponsors for the show, Shobi and Jam Software, and we'll tell you about both of those as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
I am exhausted. I've been up since 1:30 a.m.
What?
Yeah, so it's like 3:30 p.m. my time, so I've been up since 1:30. So like I am hitting the wall among all walls. So,
well, I've had three espressos since dinner time, so I'm pretty buzzed.
You're good to go.
Yeah.
So right after we got off the show last week, recording, the news came out from the Wall Street Journal about Alphabet. Google. I don't know if it's an Alphabet. Google is folding Chrome OS into Android, and of course that sets off the sirens among the tech blogger sphere about, you know, this, that, and the other. And then I guess it was earlier this week, Google came out and kind of said that's not the case. We're very committed to Chrome OS. But they did leave themselves some wiggle room around there. And, you know, in my opinion, this is just from my opinion, and I hate to say this, but I don't think like 99% of the tech bloggers can reasonably talk about Chrome OS with any sort of authority.
Nope.
Because they've not used it, they don't understand it, they don't understand what it's for. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's like you can't – like I'm not qualified to write op-eds about like Windows 10, what's wrong with it, and why no one should do it. If you've not used Chrome OS, if you've not deployed it, if you've not used it in a classroom among 30 students, don't talk to me about it because you don't understand it. I mean, I don't mean to be rude to people, but this is like that's the absolute truth. Again – there are situations where it's a better deployment than iPads and vice versa. But to completely act like it's a terrible OS and it was always doomed. I mean, Ben Thompson is one of the only tech writers that is like pro Chrome OS.
And he actually has one and uses one. Yeah.
He uses one. So I think if I'm just, you know, giving my opinion of what I think the end game is here. I think it's Android apps running on top of Chrome OS. The only caveat could be is, I think I read an article in Ars Technica, is it's completely possible that Android is getting rewritten from the ground up, and Chrome OS is a part of that.
Yeah, I suppose what we're talking about here is what does folding mean? You know, firstly, I suppose my question, Bradley, is why do we believe the Wall Street Journal at all? I mean, apart from the fact that they're a reputable news organization, are there reasons for that report to be credible? And I think the answer is yes, there are reasons for that to be credible. And the main one is actually because basically Google have said this was going to happen. You know, Sundar Pichai has said that, quote unquote, over time, Android and Chrome are going to merge in some way. And obviously, you know, Ben Thompson that we mentioned, he had a thing in his newsletter recently where he said, look, it's obvious that the cost implications for, you know, running two operating system programs side by side at Google, both of them are costs, whereas for Apple, iOS is what makes the differentiation that gets them the hardware margins that they get, whereas for Google, they don't have that benefit. So there's obviously a massive cost saving to do. And I think, you know, you wonder why do we have two separate OS programs at Google? I think there's a very solid case for merging them together. I mean, if you look at Microsoft, they've got, you know, one operating system to rule them all, and Apple more or less has three quarters of one operating system and a small bit of differentiation on top for each different platform. You know, iOS and OS X and tvOS and watchOS, they're all basically the same thing underneath with, you know, different user interface libraries and different selections of APIs available on each. But fundamentally, they're not based on different core operating system technologies. So I think there's reasons to do it. The other overwhelming reason to do it is that Android fundamentally sucks from an architecture and security point of view and an update point of view. That is frankly an embarrassment. And I think what Chrome OS has been able to do with direct updates and secure foundations and reliable software, I think it would make a ton of sense to be able to take the Android APIs and put it on that base rather than take whatever Chrome OS has got to offer and try and put that on the foundation of Android at the moment. So to me, it makes a ton of sense for something to change. But whether or not that means that Chrome OS is going away or not is a matter for debate.
Because I know there's some outliers, but the majority of Chrome OS sales are new or U.S. education.
Yeah.
And
the huge majority.
Yeah, huge majority. And so why is that important? Well, most schools, the deployment decision today is iPad or Chrome OS. That's most schools. I know there are Android tablet deployments. I know there are Mac deployments. I know there are PC deployments. I realize that. I'm seeing from most schools. Most of the schools I talk to, anyways. Yep. That is their that's their way in. Mm-hmm. Kid, they sell you Google Apps. They sell you these computers that are incredibly easy to deploy, incredibly easy to manage. There's a lot to like there from an administrative standpoint. Yeah. A lot to like there from an end user standpoint as well. They work well. And if you live in the Google ecosystem, they work really, really well. There's a lot of creative tasks they stink at compared to iPad. But that's a story from a different day. And so, I think there's more to the story. I think it could be a lot of something along the lines of the teams are merging to work together, to share things, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's like in 3 years, it's basically Android on cheap hardware with basically a lot to the Chrome browser. I don't think that's what this end game is, like Android as it exists today.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the experience in Chrome OS right now, I mean, what you basically get is you get a really good Google Docs and Google Drive experience, and you get a pretty mediocre experience of everything else. I mean, you get the full web, with Flash and everything, but if you look at what you would consider actual apps that go along with Chrome OS, I mean, some of them are terrible, and some of the fundamental tools that you need to work are terrible. For example, dealing with PDFs on a Chromebook is an absolute nightmare. There are a couple of PDF apps, but none of them are even close to what Preview on the Mac was 10 years ago. There are just some fundamental things that are not there. And if you look at any of these, if you follow people in education on Twitter or whatever who are into Chrome OS, they'll often say, here's 15 things you didn't know you could do with Chromebook. And it's literally, 15 apps that you've never heard of from companies you've never heard of, which are all free, which means that they're not going to be there next year. And you're sort of looking at it going, outside of that little bit of Google Docs, you're kind of looking at it going, great that it's free, okay. But, personally, I feel that schools spend too much time trying to find free apps and not enough time, building a foundation on things that are actually stable and sustainable. And you see people every year upset because the free app they depended on went away. Whereas the apps that you pay for tend to stay around a little bit longer. No guarantee, of course.
Well, and I think a lot of the apps in education that I know we can rely on are, software as a service.
Yeah.
I think, things we pay for, like per student basis. And of course, it's important to remember a lot of these Chromebook sales come with contracts. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of them are 3-year contracts. So, we're a few years away from, they could, basically cut it off. But again, the Google Apps tie-in is important for schools, keeps kids in the Google ecosystem. So I guess I just think there's more to meet the eye, but I do, it's hard. I think a lot of people in the tech media, when they see Chrome OS, they see Netbook 2.0 without actually understanding what it is used for. And it's not perfect, just as no deployment is perfect.
Yep.
But there is it does do what it does well, mm-hmm. In terms of it's a great Google, in the Google ecosystem, it is incredible.
I just think that the problem that Google's got is that Chrome OS is just subscale. If you were sitting on two operating system projects, one of which was selling 1 billion units a year and one of which was selling less than 10 million units, which one is going to really be the most important one? Okay. And I think there's actually much better architectural things in Chrome OS in the foundations than there is on Android, but Android's the one with the APIs and the users that are winning. And, if you look at all the apps you can get for Android, none of those apps really are powerful or popular on Chrome OS. Take for example, Evernote. Sure, you've got the Evernote web interface, but it's not really integrated. It's still that you're looking at Evernote in a browser. Whereas what you really want is you want something that's tightly integrated fundamentally with your Google Drive. And I think if I was in charge of that, I would certainly be looking at how do I get the security, the trustworthiness of the hardware and software configuration, and the direct updates that we have in Chrome OS, and how do I get the Android runtime onto that? But surely they're not going the other way and taking the Android foundations and trying to put the Chrome OS top end on it, because that would be building on the sand, I think.
There's an article, the listeners, and this from Ars Technica. There's a product called Cloud Ready. You can load onto a crappy PC and then have similar to a Chromebook experience. There are a few things that's missing, but we'll have a link to that. It's kind of a neat read if you're looking for a weekend project. That all kind of came out, was debated and refuted and discussed in between the show and a recording. So I'm glad we kind of got to step back and watch it unfold. But I think whatever we see is the article mentioned 2017, so it's a few years away regardless. But I think that does affect what you think about doing. If you are considering a Chrome OS deployment, that does have to ring in your mind of like, okay, what's the future of this platform?
Yeah, that's a level of uncertainty that is not going to settle down until we see the next product cycle. So sure, there are updates in the works to Chrome OS. There are Chromebook products, on the way. But do we see Chrome OS as we sort of know it today survive into the next product cycle and so on? And there's no roadmap for it, so we're going to have to just wait and see based on what comes out. But I think in the meantime, Apple benefits hugely from that uncertainty, because if you were about to start a one-to-one project, would you be buying a Chromebook right now? I'm not totally sure about that. I don't think anybody who's got a Chrome OS deployment is in trouble. Absolutely not. I'm not saying that, like you said, Bradley, they're not going away tomorrow. But I think if you're trying to build a long-term project, you're going to need a little bit more reassurance now as to what you're going to end up running in 3 or 4 years' time.
Yeah, that long-term is the key, because you're really not thinking about this deployment, but also next, because you want to build upon each deployment as you go with the foundations and the tools you have. So it'll be good to watch. I think you've had a fun experience with Amazon Web Services.
Yes, I have. I have been playing around with Amazon Glacier, and I have a story to tell. Basically, what I've been doing, Bradley, is with the iPad Pro coming up, and I've been spending time trying to do more on my iPad and just kind of go even more towards the cloud than I already have, which is pretty far. The one kind of boat anchor that was floating about was I had this external hard drive that I had had for years, and I just kept around, and it contained things like my Aperture library from times past, some old master podcasts that we wanted to keep around for various reasons, other kinds of just videos that I had ripped from DVDs or whatever, like school DVDs and things, plays that the school had done in the past and so on. And it wasn't data that I was particularly frequently accessing, but it wasn't stuff that I wanted to just delete either. So I was wondering what to do with it. So I thought, well, why not try and just take, a month or whatever and try and upload it to the cloud. And of course, we've got a couple of options there. One, we've got unlimited Google Drive space because we're education, which is quite a nice thing to have. But I've also, over the many years been using Amazon S3 for various things. And I thought, why not put a copy in both places just for safety? So I was looking at Amazon S3 is their storage service. And what you can do there is you can upload it and then you can say, I want these files or objects, as they're called in S3, to be stored at a certain level of quality. And they have a standard quality, which costs a certain amount. And then they have a reduced redundancy version, which is a little bit less durable. And then they have one called Infrequent Access and one called Glacier. And the idea is that the S3 standard is sort of working space. And then each of those tiers below are for less and less frequently or less important, in the case of reduced redundancy, less and less frequently accessed data. So in terms of costs, what you're looking at here is you're looking at for standard Amazon S3, which is 11 nines durability, right, which is probably more durable than the planet itself, I think, 3 cents per gigabyte per month is what it costs you to store data on Amazon S3. The reduced redundancy version, which is only 4 nines, 99.99% durability, is 2.4 cents per gigabyte per month. And then the infrequent access layer is 1.25 cents per gigabyte per month. And Glacier is $0.007. So what's that? 0.7 of 1 cent per gigabyte per month to store in Amazon Glacier. So it's really cheap stuff. But there are other costs to go around it, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
One question I have is, why not, because you have a Mac Mini that you keep on all the time, right?
Yep.
So why not just either put it on that hard drive and let Backblaze back it up, or plug that external into that hard drive or that Mac and just keep it on there as kind of a, keep it there, then have Backblaze back up that USB drive. Like, why go cloud only?
Well, I suppose one of the reasons is that eventually that's going to go away as well. You know, I think what I'm looking at is just, you know, say, okay, you got Backblaze, but then, you know, if the house burns down, what happens next and so on? What if the world comes to an end? And partly I was just curious about, you know, what would it take, or what are the implications of doing something like this, to just have a kind of all eventualities covered, last chance I can get it back from here. And one of the things I wanted to put in there, Bradley, was a copy of my, a sort of long-term copy of my Aperture library, which I have migrated since to Photos app, and it's all in iCloud Photo Library. So that's my working copy there. But then I had about a couple of hundred gigabytes of master files from my old SLR camera that I wanted to keep around. So what I did with that was I gathered them all up. I opened Aperture sort of for the last time, and I exported out a version, which is Aperture's notion of the master file plus all the modifications you've put on the picture. Burn that all to a JPEG, if you like, and save that out in a folder. So I had these two folders, one with masters, one with versions, and each of them was a couple hundred gigabytes. So I was thinking, well, why not stick it up there as well? I mean, I take your point about using Backblaze, and I take your point about putting it on my local server, but ideally, I just wanted to have multiple backups, if you like. And this, there were different ways to do it, and one was to, I decided to put them all into Google Drive as well. And then I, as a backup, I was going to put them into Amazon S3.
Well, I think the backup there is important, because your Google Drive account is your school's account. And so if for some reason they showed you the door today,
and then
somehow you got locked out of your account without being able to like download that stuff, you would like to be able to at least have it somewhere. So yeah, I mean, it's not bad. Like my photos live in Backblaze, in Dropbox, in Flickr, in Google Photos, and then on the Time Machine backup as well.
I think photos are unique in the sense that they are the one piece of data in your life you literally can never recreate.
You can't buy them. Like music, you could always rebuy it.
No.
Or movies,
and
you can rebuy
it. A presentation, you could write it again, and it would probably be as good.
If not better,
in fact, yeah. But you can never make your children 4 years old again. So that's why photos are so kind of, you know, important and precious.
Well, I think it's one of the reasons it's also the most expensive thing to store, because everybody is unique. Every file is unique. Where in music, it's like, you know, Apple can store one album the same amount of times.
Yeah, you cannot deduplicate photos reasonably at all. No. So basically what I did here, Bradley, was I took, normally when I use Amazon S3, what I do is I would use Transmit from Panic to upload files there, which is, you know, Transmit started as an FTP program years ago and gained support for Amazon S3 as well. And that's a great app, but it doesn't support really big files. There's a 5 gigabyte limit on single part uploads to Amazon S3, which is fine for most things, but obviously I had zipped these into archives by year. So some of them were, you know, 15, 20, 25. I think the biggest file I uploaded was 35 gigabytes in size. So I had to use a different tool. And this is the first time I'd used it, but Amazon have a command line set of tools called AWS CLI, which is a package that supports multi-part upload. So you just basically give an SSH-like command. You say, AWS S3 copy, and you give your local file and the remote S3 URL, and it just copies it away, and it will automatically detect if the file's over the single part upload limit, and it will handle multi-part upload for you just fine. So that was dead easy. It was just a matter of, you know, start it up, leave it going overnight, days at a time, whatever, and then come back and do another one and so on. So that worked really well. That's a really nice way to do it.
Yeah, it's you almost feel like Amazon is like the retail store is like a public charity for the web services. Yeah. Because how essential that, you know, that Amazon Web Services is now, mm-hmm. and it can do so much. I mean, it's very, very flexible in what you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by Amazon Web Services because, I mean, no less a company than Netflix run everything they have on AWS. You know, they don't have data centers anymore. I think they have or are about to just shut down their last proprietary data center, and everything they do is on AWS. So if it's good enough for Netflix, it's pretty much good enough for you, and certainly good enough for me as well.
And Dropbox runs off of Netflix as well. Or I'm sorry, Amazon. Yeah, Amazon. Again, I'm long day, but yeah. So a lot of Amazon's competitors run their products on top of Amazon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Amazon wins regardless.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. They're the standard oil of the 21st century, aren't they?
I mean, are there any, like, you know, you mentioned the different like types of uploads you can do. Are there any like negatives to Glacier that you can see?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest negative to Glacier is understanding its pricing model, which is genuinely very difficult. And it's not difficult to understand how much it costs to keep stuff there, and it's free to put stuff there as well. There's no fee to upload to Glacier, but there is a very unusual model for pricing how you get your data back from Glacier. And really and truly, what Amazon want you to do is they want you to restore very small amounts, very slowly. Now, the whole point of Glacier is that it's for large data sets that you will almost 99% guaranteed never, ever want to look at again. And I'm certainly hoping that this data falls into that category, that between iCloud and then Google Drive, I'm never going to need this third backup, but I would like it to be there anyway. So what they want to do is they want you to restore your data very slowly over a very long period of time. So, and they price it accordingly so that you are seriously penalized if you say, right, I just want everything back from Glacier right now. What they want you to do is you want to take a small percentage at a time. So the way it works, Bradley, is that you get to restore 5% of the data that you have stored in Glacier each month for free, right? So 5% a month is how much you can get back. And obviously what that means is that the more you have in Glacier, the more you can get back each month for free. So there's almost like an incentive to put more in so you can restore more if you needed to. But they really want you to trickle restore your data. So if you say you store 100 gigabytes in Glacier, you get to restore 5 gigabytes per month for free, which is about 170 megabytes per day. And what I did while I was playing around with this is I had about 100 gigabytes of files in Glacier, and I made the mistake of asking for them all to be restored in one go because I wanted to rearrange the way I had stored some data without really realizing what was going on here. It was only when I looked at the Cost Explorer tool on Amazon, I realized, ouch, I've just been hit with a big fee. So I ended up paying about $120 just for the privilege of moving files between two buckets because I was a bit stupid about it. So at the point I realized that I had uploaded all my zip files to S3, but they hadn't been put in Glacier yet, because what you do is you put it in normal S3 first, and then over time you can set rules that will migrate data into Glacier based on the files aging out. So you can say archive to Glacier after 10 days after creation or 100 days after creation or whatever number you want. So I had put my stuff up, but I had a rule that was like 3 or 4 days. So the stuff hadn't gone into Glacier yet. So I stopped the rule and I thought, well, I better rethink this. And the reason I wanted to rethink it was because if I've got these large objects, what if I need to get one back? And say it's like 30 gigabytes. I'm going to have to ask for them to restore 30 gigabytes in one go, and that could be very expensive. I mean, it could basically become cost prohibitive to restore some of that data. So what I did was I thought, well, I'd better re-upload all these files individually rather than as big zip archives. So, you know, having spent like 2 weeks or 3 weeks trying to upload all this data, I thought, well, I don't want to do that again. So I started up an Amazon EC2 instance on their cloud, SSH'd into there from my iPad, downloaded all the files to that virtual machine in Amazon's data center, unzipped them all there, and then synced them all back to S3, which took about, you know, a couple hours of transferring files around about, because it was obviously on a much faster connection to S3 than my laptop at home. After I did that, I learned that you can actually you can request Amazon to restore byte ranges of larger archives, but it's not obvious to me how to do that with the tools. I think you might have to write a little bit of custom code to trickle restore your data off of Glacier. So I thought it was simpler. You know, say I lost one picture that I really wanted, I could go in and say, okay, restore this one object from Glacier. That would probably be less than 5% of my total, so I could just restore it immediately for free, and that would be fine. So that's what I did, and it was so far so good. I haven't actually turned on my Glacier rule again yet, so I'm paying a little bit more than I probably should be for storing that stuff just yet, but I just want to make sure I've got it all right before I say, okay, let's commit all this to Glacier. But I think I'm pretty happy that having that stuff in Google Drive and having it on Glacier, I can just say, right, let's just freeze that for now, and if I ever need it, we'll come back. But hopefully we never will.
What app on the iPad were you using to basically connect and unzip those files?
That was another Panic app. That was Prompt by Panic, which is a really nice iOS SSH client. Supports public key login and things like that. And what I would do is I would just connect to that machine, see what was going on, disconnect from it again, and leave it for a couple of hours, go back and check it again and so on. So it was all mobile. You know, I could even have done it from my phone. Prompt is a universal app, really, really nice app, and one that I've been using for years.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Jamp Software. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power the use of Apple products in schools, Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs. They have a great app called Cast for Focus that teachers can use to take control of their classroom experience with iPads. It allows them to quickly gain a student's attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV, they can choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within the app. Learn more about Cast for Focus and the Cast for Suite at jampsoftware.com. JAMFsoftware.com. Yeah, in these kind of tools, the fact that they like exist and you can have all these options to spread your data around really shows you how far we've come in like the last 15 years. You know, like these projects, you know, teams, freelance, what their work people do, and you see this plethora of options to share files, to sync files, to backup files. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't a decade ago when not all this was like a cost prohibitive from a upload perspective on your home bandwidth, and the tools weren't available. Yeah, and so now it's kind of like, you know, why do you even need USB hard drives? Like, you know, it's like, I mean, the only reason I actually make like a Time Machine backup of my Mac is easier to restore from. And so I can imagine if Apple ever built like, you know, backup your Mac to iCloud and you could restore from that.
Yep.
You know, why do you even need a, you know, who even needs a USB drive?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly people who live in extremely bandwidth-constrained situations, but for people who don't, you know, and I always get this on Twitter every time I sort of talk about, oh, I'm cloud-first or whatever. Everybody who's got a crappy internet connection comes up going, well, what about me and, you know, in one of the islands or whatever, you know. And yeah, that's true, but just because that's somebody's problem doesn't mean that other people are not beyond that. Right. So if I have, you know, 10 or 15 megabits per second upload and 150 down, the fact that I can do that it makes it different again, you know. And I don't think we should say that nobody should use the cloud just because some people can't use the cloud. And certainly being cloud only for a lot of the stuff that I have now has not presented a serious problem to me in a very long time. And that includes all situations involving travel and things like that. And what has really helped actually is that my mobile phone provider allows me to use data abroad in a lot of different countries, which is great. I noticed recently going to Dubai where I couldn't do that it was a little more of a constraint. But, you know, for the 99% of my life where I'm in my home country and I'm on my own networks and even on 3G, being cloud first isn't really that big of a problem anymore. And I mean, when, you know, you think back to what we started the school with, you know, one server on premise with one backup drive. I mean, how sort of scary that is to me today compared to having all that data in the cloud and data centers of the quality of Google's data center that Drive lives in and the one that Amazon runs. You know, there's absolutely no possibility that a school of our scale could create or rent space in or build or manage any facility with anything like that level of competence in management and connection to the internet and quality of service. So for me, it's phenomenal that we can get access to that kind of resource these days.
Well, and you have to look at your situation and decide what the best tools are.
Yeah.
You know, if you do have a 1 meg internet connection up and down, you have to make decisions based on that. Mm-hmm. And so like email has been one of those things that's interesting to me to watch over the past, like say 10 years. Like, you know, when I just celebrated my, I guess 11 years in like kind of the working world, mm-hmm. professional environment. And like when I started, it was like everybody ran Exchange and there was no hosted mail service in terms of like the, you know, obviously there's some IMAP providers, but there's nothing that offered like hosted mail, calendar, contacts, you know, email, and then maybe like documents on top of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fast forward 11 years, that's pretty much the default for most organizations of, you know, that aren't like large Fortune, you know, 100. I mean, yeah. I know there's a tipping point to where, you know, paying for Exchange 365 would cost you more than hiring Exchange administrators to manage them on site. I mean, I know there is a tipping point, but for like a lot of, you know, certainly small and then mid and even some larger organizations, mm-hmm. like they just, I mean, it's a turnkey solution to roll out Google Apps, to roll out Office 365. That seems to be the way the world's going. Mm-hmm. But if you have a really, really flaky internet connection, like that's something you have to consider with your data. Like, you know, we probably do need to have it here locally if our internet goes out or we have a very slow connection or, mm-hmm. you know, you have to play to your strengths. And there are certainly strengths to having that on site because you can just, it's there and you can deal with it. Mm-hmm. But you play to whatever strengths that your organization has based on the environment you live in.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You've got to get that right. And I suppose if you went in all starry-eyed going, we're going to do cloud everything, and then you realize that the internet connection can't cope with what it is you're trying to do and you can't get any more. I mean, this is something I always say to schools whenever I go in to help them with iPad deployments is I always say, look, it's not that you need to beef up your internet connection on day one, but you need to know on day one that it will take you X months and X pounds to get to a better internet connection. And you have to have explored your strategies or your options for the future in order to know that if things come to the crunch, you know, if we start getting slow, we're going to realize that it's going to take us 3 months to get another cable put in or whatever. Whereas if you go in thinking, well, it's just going to be fine, it'll probably not be fine forever, but then you're delaying even longer by not having done that research at the start.
Let's take our last sponsor of the night, find folks at Shobi. They're an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can assign, collect, and review their students' work on their iPad and then provide feedback directly on the documents through annotations, through annotation features such as the pen tool, text, and voice notes. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of iPad apps or by using the built-in tools right inside Shobi. Shobi has a new gradebook feature with Shobi Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review, and export student grades. And they have other features like student portfolios and parent access coming soon. Now, Shobi Basic is free, so teachers can roll it out in their classroom, no cost. Just search for Shobi on the App Store. And Shobi Pro is a great upgrade if you kind of all in on Shobi. And if you pay for it by the year, you get a 30% discount. So learn more about Shobi Pro with its gradebook and enhanced annotation features at Shobi.com, or you can search for Shobi in the App Store, Shobie.com. Mm-hmm. So what we wanted to finish up with today is a tool that we kind of fell into a few years ago, mm-hmm. that over time we really have come to rely on it. And it's going to sound completely random, but it's Wufoo Forms. So Wufoo at its core is, you know, it's to build online forms. Like, you know, you need to collect data. That's what you do. Like, you know, at the foundation level, like it and Google Forms are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And if all you're wanting to do is like, you know, have a little sign up sheet, Google Forms does it fine because obviously it's free. Where Wufoo is a paid product, if you, you know, use it at all, there's a free version, but it's very limited. Mm-hmm. So we kind of fell into it for a few things. So I want to talk about some of the ways we use it and what we use it for. So the first thing is online donations. So we started out years ago, like, you know, we just wanted to do something simple. So we rolled out like PayPal. You could donate via PayPal. you know, it is what it is. Like, it's not the best user experience. And a lot of people get concerned because, like, I don't have a PayPal account. I can't donate. Like, you know, even though it says, like, just pay with a credit card here. Like, I mean, it's people associate PayPal with eBay and it is what it is. So we did that for a few years. It was fine. Like, but I wanted something different. So Wufoo can integrate with everything. Tons of external services and payment providers. So Authorize.net, Braintree is another popular one, and then Stripe, which is what I wanted to use. So Stripe, all it is, if you've never used it, is like a payment gateway service. Like, it hooks into other things. Like, you never know you're using Stripe. It just is the pipes that connect the sinks together. And so we had a Stripe account. The fast deposits, they usually deposit within 2 days. Really, really fair fees. I mean, it's no different than, you know, most places, but it's just really kind of easy to work with. So we rolled out online donations, like one-time online donations. And so you create a form and you can actually say, okay, have these options for people to donate. And then $10, $25, $50, $100, $500. And we just rolled it up, put a link on our website, say click here to make online donations, and we got rid of the PayPal stuff. We still have people paying through PayPal. We just don't have anybody new doing it. We don't want to cancel those because it is free money. So again, it works very well. You can you can customize it where you get certain people get certain email notifications. So like on this payment, our director of development gets every email notification that, like, hey, so and so donated. So she can then funnel that into our Donor Connect program from RenWeb, where she tracks donations. So one thing to mention is RenWeb has a online donations program. I'm just not a big fan of it. Just, it is what it is. I mean, if you've ever listened to the show, you know I have a love-hate relationship with RenWeb. So I just wanted to do something more that I controlled a little bit from a user experience perspective. The other thing you can do is you can funnel those people, like if they submit that form, you can funnel them to like a MailChimp list. So if you wanted to like follow up with those people yearly, or you wanted to kind of run them through a automation flow in MailChimp where you say, okay, immediately send them this email thanking them for their donation. In 3 days, send in this follow-up email saying, okay, here's some of the things we are doing with our annual fund giving this year. Maybe a month later, send them another reminder just saying, again, thank you for your donation. You can do all sorts of things once you get them funneled into MailChimp. Now, so they can go into MailChimp, they can go into multiple places, but they also stay right in Wufoo in a database. So you can export those out into Excel, or you can just view them right there on the spot. So it's very, very flexible. But again, you can have email notifications. You can even do SMS notifications as well. So super flexible for one-time online donations. Again, you do the front end through Wufoo and the back end through Stripe. You can customize your forms to your heart's content. So even your users don't even know they're using Wufoo because you can actually embed it inside of your website. Okay. So one-time online donations is the first thing we do it for. Second thing, big surprise, is recurring donations. Stripe supports this as well. So we have people that give. I think we start on that. We have $5, $10, $25, $100, and then $250 a month. And so five seems crazy to do. But like to me, $5 is at that moment, like that threshold where I don't even care. Yeah. I mean, you don't even see it. I mean, I could be paying something $5 a month for something for 10 years and would probably never notice. So my thought was, like, if there's somebody that, say, wouldn't give 25 a month, they might give five. Well, that's 60 a year. And then I would rather have someone paying $5 a month than paying like almost paying $100 here and there, like $100 this year, nothing next year, $100 the third year, because it creates systematic giving.
Yep.
So easy to set up, comes out automatically. Main downside with the not a downside from your perspective, if you have a different perspective on it. There is no easy mechanism for the customer to cancel that recurring gift through Wufoo. So they basically have to email the school and say, hey, I would like to cancel this donation. So that's awkward.
Yeah.
But it
feels weird.
I don't know. Yeah, it does feel weird. But it's just they don't have that feature built in. That would be nice. Another thing we use on top of this with the recurring donation is a product called Stunning, and it's at bestunning.net. So what this does is this hooks into Stripe. It's obviously through its API. And as you have cards that are recurring donations that come up for expiration, they will, and you set up your templates, they will contact those customers and have and provide them with a way to update that through Stripe. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, 1 month out, 2 weeks out, you know, a week out, so, hey, don't forget to update your card for your annual fund giving. So it works very well, and it's a very fair, like the pricing model is based on how much revenue they can quote unquote save for you. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So again, the online donations, one-time donations, super, super easy to use. We just started a kind of our big annual fund campaign today. And so I'm starting to see the Stripe emails coming through where, you know, people are paying. And from a financing perspective, from a financial office perspective, it's incredibly easy to determine what people donated, but then also what fees you paid on top of that.
Okay.
Because from an accounting perspective, like if you donate $100 online, the school technically doesn't have $100 in revenue to book.
Yeah.
So, again, Stripe, very, very easy to use for our accounting department as well. Third thing is event registration. So, like, do you guys have a like, fall festival at your school and things like that?
Yeah, we do. We have a craft fair that is 2 weeks away.
So, yeah, we do like a fall festival. We'll have donuts for dad. So we use it as kind of a poor man's event registration. Mm-hmm. Like, are you coming to this event? You know, if you're coming, like, you know, if it's something that has a meal, you know, what do you choose? And then mm-hmm. so we can, you know, funnel all that through WooFoo, eventually dump it to an Excel spreadsheet, send it off to a caterer, for example. And it's just a nice interface. And we can, obviously, once you get it into Excel, you know, you can do, you know, a lot of things with it. So yeah, simple event registration. Another thing we use it for is a very simple online store. Do you guys have like a school store at your school?
We do not, no. Like, you mean like merchandise?
Things yeah, like that? T-shirts and that.
I've always thought we should have that, but we don't. Maybe I'd put that in my long-term plan to start something like that.
And you could, you know, you could sub it out to Spears Incorporated. Yeah. And so a good example of what we did here, like if the terrorist attack that happened in Chattanooga back in July, mm-hmm. there were some Marines killed and shot. And so a lot of people were doing fundraisers for the Fallen Heroes Fund. So we sold a T-shirt that we gave all the profits to the Fallen Heroes Fund. So like that all happened on a Saturday in terms of like we decided to do that. Mm-hmm. And we were able to easily have an order form online, pay via credit card, and we could share it via social media. And, you know, and instead of people having to like mail in checks and, you know, send in paper order forms, mm-hmm. again, incredibly easy. And then again, from an accounting perspective, it's very easy to determine how much money we actually received off that shirt and then figure out what our cost on the shirt was too. And one of the things we started selling recently were our lunch tickets. So the way we handle lunch here is you can do like the all you can eat plan. You pay, depending on what grade you're in, it's like either $500 or $650 you can eat every day. We also sell like these tickets that says, okay, well, you're basically pre-buying for 30 meals. Well, last year, like we had that, and then we added a 10-day ticket. This year, a 10-meal ticket. Well, we only accepted checks. And so what would happen is they would get low. We would email the parents like, hey, you know, little Johnny's lunch ticket only has 5 left. Well, they would forget to send in a check. Well, now we sell them online. Now, we did raise the cost of the online version just enough to cover the fees, and we're very upfront with that. But lunch is not a profit center for us. We, you know, it's like you hope to break even on it. Mm-hmm. And so we raised, like, I think if you know, if it was like $142 for this ticket, it's like $145 now just to cover the fees.
Yeah.
And now when we tell parents, hey, your kid's lunch ticket's almost up, we can provide a link in there and like, hey, click here to buy one. And when they buy it, it sends an email to the school secretary. She generates a ticket because they're individually numbered and because, you know, it is basically our currency, mm-hmm. and logs which kid it goes to, puts it in the teacher's box, and we're off and running. So it's really doing, you know, that's one of the things that's really knocked down the number of kids we have to charge lunch every day. Because obviously mm-hmm. a kid's going to eat whether they have money or not.
Yeah.
But we would just then charge their account. And that's really knocked down the number of kids who charged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big efficiency saving.
How do you guys handle lunch at your school?
It's all cash for us. We don't have any prepayment system like that. So I would say probably the minority of kids use our lunch service. Quite a lot of kids bring a packed lunch to our school. But that's just kind of the way it's evolved. We haven't really changed it very much over the years. It's just not something people ever really talk to us about, you know, should we do this or that. They're more interested in what's being made available to the kids, you know, the menu and things like that, rather than different payment options. But we're still quite basic on a lot of this stuff. We're nowhere near as sophisticated as the things you've described. I mean, we've used Eventbrite for a couple of things that we've done just as a trial. We've surveyed the parents about possibly, you know, making it possible to buy a ticket for the Christmas play using Eventbrite or something like that. And people have indicated that they would be interested in doing that. So it's definitely something that we're interested in. I mean, I think one of the things about a lot of these payment processors is sometimes they're US specific. I'm not sure if Stripe is available internationally. I'm not sure that it is. But Eventbrite do handle credit card payments in the UK. So it's one way that we could do that. It's just to go sort of a pure Eventbrite route.
Well, and a lot of things that schools run into with online payments mm-hmm. is you're generally not making a profit on things. Yeah. And so like lunch, I mean, again, mm-hmm. it's not a loss leader, but we just hope to break even, you know, plus or minus a couple thousand. Mm-hmm. And so you can't really like say, oh, we'll just like eat the cost of this because we'll sell more. Well, selling more doesn't really help us.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing to consider.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I guess the future is like Apple Pay off the kid's iPad.
Yeah. Parents will be swiping their Apple Watch when they come into school.
So again, you can handle simple stuff like t-shirts, little simple order forms, simple event registration, even if it has payments, very, very simple stuff. You can't get real complex where you could say, okay, I want a t-shirt in large, a second t-shirt in medium, a second t-shirt in extra large. Like it's not meant to be like a clothing store. I mean, that's mm-hmm. where you'd need something like Shopify, to do that.
Yep.
But again, if you're just selling something very, very simple, real quick, easy, good to go. Mm-hmm. Now, the last one is the most fun. And it's the one I think like you could kind of get on board with more mm-hmm. In terms of like you could see it working at your school. It is how we do admissions tracking.
Okay.
So I mentioned that admissions at our school is a big deal. It's how we survive. If kids don't enroll, we don't eat. And so we are very intentional with our admissions process. Like we have a certain flow that they each, like when someone inquires about the school, it kind of sets off a series of triggers on. We mail them a packet. We schedule a tour for them to come in. Our big thing is here, like no one really applies to the school in terms of like, here is my money for the application fee until they take a tour. We want them to come in and see it. Mm-hmm. This is, unless it's like a sibling that's coming for an existing family, but like we want people to come in and see it. Like we feel like our best asset is our teachers. And if you see the students in class, like you'll fall in love with it. So it's always a lot more fun to do school tours. And they're individual, so like we don't even do group tours. Like every family gets individual attention from the headmaster. He spends, literally will spend an hour or more with every family that's interested. So he's really, he takes it very seriously. We don't even have an admissions director. Like it's with the headmaster. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really cool. So what we do is we have a WFU form where they request a packet. So we get information about them, kid's name, what year they're interested in. Because mm-hmm. Sometimes right now, we're enrolling for this current year, but also 2016, 2017. Because we've enrolled probably 45 kids since July 1st, which is unheard of for most independent schools. We had people moving in. It was kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. So we had a kid start this week. And we also have people that are inquiring about next year and even sometimes the next year. Like parents are really on the ball.
Yeah.
And so you pick what your academic year you're interested in, what grades, how many kids you have, email, all that pertinent information. And that goes into WFU. Now, WFU, again, can dump into a database that you can export out into Excel spreadsheets. One of the things it doesn't do natively is dump into a Google spreadsheet. Okay. So why would you want to do a Google spreadsheet versus an Excel spreadsheet? Well, the Google spreadsheet could be shared by multiple people, and it is live updating. Well, obviously, admissions are ongoing, so it's an ongoing project for us. And so what we do is I'm using a service called Zapier. Is that how you say it? It's kind of like a poor man. It's kind of like the, I think, rich man's if this, then that, maybe. Yeah. Is that a good way to say it? Maybe it's the enterprise version of it. So it hooks in to... It hooks our WFU account into a Google spreadsheet called admissions form from WFU. And then around that, we have created columns around that, packet sent, we put the date, mm-hmm. Tour scheduled, put the date, follow-up call put the date. So we can be very intentional to know, like, okay, where is it each family on the admissions process? And so we can be like, if someone hasn't come, like we can say, okay, well, we need to follow back up with them. No one's called them since the school tour, or we've sent them a packet, but they've not scheduled a tour. Why not? Let's follow up with an email, follow up with a phone call, and mm-hmm. just try to at least get them in the door. Cause we always feel like if we can get parents in the door to see our school, it will fall in love with it.
Yeah.
And so our main goal is always to enroll them, but our main goal in the beginning is just to get them in the door to meet with the headmaster, take a tour, see the students, see the teachers, see the building in action. And then we really think they'll fall in love with it. So it's nice because like this is ongoing, can be accessed by multiple people. They can see where people are at on the flow of the admissions work, admissions flow, and it's automatic. So when someone sends out that form, within a few minutes, it takes that information from WFU, drops it in this Google spreadsheet, and then we can kind of work people through the flow.
Yeah, it sounds good. It's a sort of more personalized CRM tool, isn't it? Customer relationship manager.
Yeah, it's a CRM tool without having to like have an entire CRM tool.
Yeah, because so many bits of that are like, because I looked into using HiRISE, the 37 Signals tool, a few mm-hmm. years ago, and it was just so kind of business. I just hated everything about it. It was like, it talked about making a deal with this person and the contract and all that kind of stuff, and it just had terminology around it that I wasn't really comfortable with in a school situation. The language wasn't right for school, and talking, making deals with people about their children just felt too weird for me.
Well, and then once they're enrolled, they're in a whole different system with us. Like, and again, RenWeb has an online application system that we're probably rolling out soon where people can start applying online, actually like doing all the paperwork online instead of filling out paper forms. So this kind of may be changing a little bit for us. Mm-hmm. But so we kind of have two systems right now. We have a pre-enrolled and then a enrolled. So once you're enrolled, you're in RenWeb. And it's not like a lot of CRM systems like, if I do a deal with one vendor, well, they probably have a thing in Salesforce or HiRISE or something like 6 months from now to call me and try to sell me something else.
Yeah.
Once the kid's in school, like it's school time. Like it's not trying to sell them on the school. We're trying to teach mm-hmm. and trying to, and it will obviously address problems if they come up. But like our main goal at that point is to teach and to do what we do best. So this is just like, these live updating spreadsheets are just to help keep us accountable to the intentional process that we've created. Okay, have they been contacted? And of course, the beauty of Google Spreadsheets is that like you can access it from anywhere and people can work on it creatively. I have my fifth grade class working on a presentation about like staying safe online. We talked about that for a class period. And I said, okay, I threw a bunch of questions out at them and said, I want you to create a presentation around this. And one of the things like we're trying to be intentional at our school about is to giving kids kind of less direction mm-hmm. and helping them to be more creative.
Yep.
There's a video that we watched about like if it was an art project, the more directions you gave them, the less colors they used on average. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to, I want you to pretend like, I've given you all these tools and I want to give you the tools to create a presentation for our fourth graders about this. And I said, I want you to craft it around, you're teaching this to someone else. And so like, I'm sitting there watching the kids like on Google spreadsheets mm-hmm. and I'm watching them all like collaboratively work at the same time, like four people to one spreadsheet, and it just works. And that's why like Google tools for that kind of stuff, it still blows my mind that it even works.
Yeah. I did exactly the same thing today. It was April's class were planning a project that they were going to do. And I had made a spreadsheet with a column for each student, and each week was a row because they were working on it like one period a week. And they all had to just fill in their column for what they were going to do. And you could see, the people who had ideas for 10 weeks worth of work versus 5 weeks, and people who didn't know what they were going to do and so on. And after you get over that, the initial silliness of it and how, kids can turn everything into a chat system, which is hilarious, I think. They started working really well, and it was great to just have one document where everybody could see. They could get ideas from other people as to what steps they needed to go through in order to get their projects done, because they're all working on different projects and making different things. But yeah, it's great fun in the classroom.
Yeah, I've learned that the restore previous revisions in Google Drive mm-hmm. is your best friend in the classroom.
Yes,
because it's always like so and so deleted my slides, and or they'll share it with somebody else to get their get feedback, and then the person will accidentally delete slides, and yeah. It's like. File, restore revisions.
Yeah, I did say to some kids, I said, by the way, just so you know, I can revert to anything you've ever typed into this document, so just be careful what you put in.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know how I got off on this Google tangent. But, yeah, so those are the kind of some of the things we use WooFoo for. It's probably – if you're a much bigger school than us, you probably do have a more, you know – custom, or not a custom, but a more turnkey solution for some of this stuff.
Yeah.
But we're kind of at that size where we need some of that automation, but not so much that I can spend a ton of money doing it. I mean, WooFoo, yeah, we pay $30 a month for the plan that we have. Mm-hmm. And then Stripe is just a, obviously there are the fees, the credit card fees.
It's proportional and to your traffic. Yeah.
Right. And it's kind of a win for me. It's very easy to create. It's a win for our director of development or headmaster because they can see the data very easily. And it's a win for our accountant. Like she loves the back end of Stripe a whole lot more than she does PayPal. Mm. It's built for her to understand how these fees translate into how money we're receiving. So we can reconcile giving accounts.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds good. Yeah. I think there's definitely scope to do more. For us, there's scope to do more in that area. I'm interested in, trying to use something like Eventbrite perhaps to sell tickets. I mean, the thing I like about Eventbrite is that you can have a digital ticket. You can put it in Passbook and then you can actually use an iOS device to check people into the venue when you do your thing as well.
Ooh.
Which is really nice. We've never done that, but we've used Eventbrite, but we've never done the kind of checking in part as well. So people can bring their device, you can scan the QR code with your device, and then there's no paper involved either way. It's pretty nice. So,
I think Square is, I think they have an Apple Pay compatible reader now as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you could even roll out Apple Pay.
Cards on the door, pretty, yeah.
Yeah, because we have a Square account and we use it. We don't use it a ton. What we use it for is at our big auction every year. Mm-hmm. We have a big fundraising dinner and people will just pay with a credit card. We have a couple of the readers logged into the account. A couple people's my cell phone, the director of development cell phone, headmaster cell phone, were there swiping cards and that works. Yeah, it works pretty well. I mean, I don't know. I would want to use it for everything, mm-hmm. but for mobile credit card payments, it is the best system.
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually, you can see a world where every iPhone becomes an Apple Pay terminal. There's probably enough chips in there that with just a software update, you could be taking Apple Pay payments on your phone from somebody else's phone. You bump them together.
Just thinking about that. Something like instead of having a reader, just somehow, if you have a Square app and you say, okay, accept payments, you bump them together. Remember the old app bump?
Yeah.
You could literally, bump these phones together and authenticate on both ends and, exchange money.
Yeah, I bet Apple's thinking about that in the background somewhere.
That's kind of what we've been doing. It's been fun for us. It's been helpful for everybody involved. So if you're looking for some little bit more automation without, breaking the bank, mm-hmm. Or investing in an entire CRM, check out WooFoo. It's WUFOO.com. It's cool that all the forms are responsive. So if people want to have to upload, because one of the things you can do is you can allow people to upload files. So one of the forms we have internally is our check request. So if someone has to buy something on a personal card they need to get reimbursed for through their Classroom account, it's responsive. And then so they can be at Walmart, for example, buy something, mm-hmm. fill out the form, and then take a picture of the receipt, and it goes right into a database that our financial secretary can then process. So it's handy that they're responsive out of the box.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. All right, shall we leave it there for today?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. iPad Pros are coming soon. Just before we go, I was going to say we're about 6 days away from iPad Pro coming out, apparently. The rumor is 11th of November, so looking forward to that.
Are they not doing pre-orders?
Nobody said anything about it. Nope. I was in conversation with some of the people from the local Apple store, and they were... they're always saying they know nothing, which I think is actually mostly true in the case of new products. But they were saying, whenever we hear, we'll let you know and stuff. But I haven't heard anything so far. So they're not saying, we'll care for pre-orders this day or whatever. So I might actually just have to go to the store and pick one up.
It's confusing. How a product that's obviously enterprise focused, how do you not do pre-orders online for that?
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know. Is it possible that there's just not going to be very many to start with? Or the flip side of that, I suppose, is it something where the demand is going to ramp up slowly? You know, they're not expecting, it's not, this isn't an iPhone launch, right? So it's not like they're going to sell out worldwide within the first 24 hours of it going on sale, I don't think, unless they've got very few of them initially, which may also be the case. You never know.
True. Yeah. It'll be fun to be, I'm not planning on purchasing one. I played out my technology purchasing for the quarter with the phone and then not one, but two Apple TVs.
We should talk about that next week as well.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. We'll talk. So I will have to live vicariously through you.
Okay. I will hopefully have one in my hands for the next show.
Thanks to our sponsors, Janth and Shobi. Mm-hmm. I am on the web at chambersdaily.com, and my Twitter account is at Bradley Chambers.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
Have a great week, everybody.